Okay, we are just coming up on the witching hour, so I will stop my share and I will mute all. And as usual, everybody will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so and remute yourself after you make any comments or questions, so we keep background noise to a minimum. Welcome all. If we have any guests with us tonight, welcome. We always welcome guests at the Ottawa PC User Group meetings. If you want to become a member, we'll be glad to have you. If you come to our website and click on the renew or join link, that'll step you through the process. It's only $20 a year, and if you join before the end of the month, you will get a bonus year for free. So you get 2 years for the $20. However, if you want to join us as a guest, please feel free to continue to do so. Later on this evening, contents of the deck in PDF format, the contents of the chat window, and the audio track will go up on our website, thanks to the hard work of Alan. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And we have a number of topics tonight, so we'll get right to it. And the first one is one of the YouTube tech items. I've actually become interested in a lot of this historical computer stuff available on YouTube. It's actually quite well done and quite interesting. And one of the ones I found quite recently was this one, The Making of GNU. So I think everybody's probably aware that Linux is actually just the kernel, and there's a whole raft of other software, compilers and editors and all kinds of linkers, all kinds of wonderful things you need to make a full operating system. And that's basically GNU. GNU is one of these weird Unix-type algorithms, which stands for GNU is not Unix, initially created by Richard Stallman of the Open Software, Free Software Federation. And this video is actually quite good, and gives you the whole background of that project. So I highly recommend it if you have any interest at all in Linux. Okay, next up we have a follow-up. Sarah sent this in. It's essentially a browser extension for Facebook that cuts out the unwanted ads. And Jeff mentions that the problem he has with Facebook is it keeps inventing new categories. So you tell it you don't want to see sports, and then it gives you baseball and hockey and so on and so forth. And so he recommends this app called, or browser extension called, Facebook Purity, which gets around all this stuff. And so basically, he says it strips all the ads out at the browser level, so you can read the Facebook content that's been posted by people you know, and you don't have to be worried with all the extraneous adverts. And you don't get inundated inadvertently with content from an ad that you inadvertently clicked on. He says the settings are highly configurable, and he recommends it to anybody who's using Facebook. In fact, his recommendation is only read Facebook on a PC through a browser, and only if you have Facebook Purity extension installed. So for those of us who don't use Facebook, that's not a problem. If you do use Facebook, then maybe Facebook Purity is something that you might want to take a look at. Highly recommended by Jeff Dubois. Okay, and a second follow-up on ad blockers. I'm going to give the floor to Tom Trottier. If Tom's around somewhere, I don't see him right now. He's here somewhere. You get to unmute your mic and talk to this slide, Tom, and then the next item is yours too.
Oh, okay. I guess you can hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So there's a variety of ad blockers and tests. So the best ad blockers for 2024, according to PC Magazine, is there. As well as ad blocking, the way people, corporations track you, is by your browser fingerprint. And what's that is basically it's a bunch of random information about your browser, the window size, God knows what else. So even though you may delete your cookies every day, there are still a variety of things, user agent and stuff, that get sent to the websites that you're using. And they use that to try and pick you out so that they see what you're interested in, and then you can they can show you the right ads. So there is there are ways to hide your browser fingerprint, which is usually by adding in a whole bunch of stuff so every time you're unique. And that's how hiding your browser fingerprint works. It doesn't actually hide the stuff that is actually useful in presenting you information. You can test your ad blocker at adblocktester.com, and hopefully you get 50 out of 50. And you can test the ad blocker and your privacy and tracking at coveryourtracks at ef.eff.org. EFF is the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the States that has a goal of privacy on the internet and of safety. And that's it. Okay. Any questions?
Thanks, Tom. And the next item is yours too, this book. And I believe you're going to share your screen on this one?
I am. Let's share screen. Yes. And that's what I want to share. There. Oh, that's cute. Well, this is... In the beginning, it was one word. One word to rule them all. This is about a meta-dictionary. And it can do a variety of things. It's not just a way of looking up the meaning of a word, but you can do a variety of things. Find the right word. Solve word problems. There's a crossword mode that gives you even more ability to solve word problems. You can look up slang and abbreviations. So, what does the word mean? Well, here you are, meta-dictionary. One look is a meta-dictionary. So it's an online dictionary portal that allows searches. And they have, about 1,000 dictionaries that they provide links to things in. So it's very useful if you want to find a variety of definitions for a word, especially when it means one thing in one context and another thing in another. Sometimes, though, you want to find the right word. So, for example, what's a good word for a military failure? Well, a defeat, a loss, a disaster, a debacle, a fiasco, a quandary maybe, a BMAR, whatever that is, a blight. There's a whole variety of words that use from it. It's like a very big thesaurus. It gives you the definition of the first word here. So if you want to look up a word for something, you look go to the thesaurus and you put in a military failure or whatever you're interested in, and it will give you a variety of words of which you can choose the one that you think is best. You can also solve Wordle, Quordle, crosswords, and other word problems. It may take a little more time than just using your mind, but it may be shorter, too. And the way that this does it is you can use search pattern symbols, like question mark, asterisk, like from regular expressions. But there's other things, like consonant, vowel. You can disallow letters. You can restrict to letters. You can unscramble. Or you can find out the meaning by giving it the meaning and then finding the word. So, for example, here is Wordle. This is today's Wordle. So I put in trace, no luck. Solid, so O-L-I are in the word, but they're not in the right position. So I went to one look, and I got rid of the letters that are not in there. And I put in five question marks, so it's a five-letter word. And there's a whole bunch of five-letter words here, none of which really have that O-L-I. You can also sort these words by what's most common or other ways, oldest, most modern. But most common, I find it works best with Wordle, at least. And I put in dimps because all the letters were different, so it gives me a better chance of finding the right letters. So now I can get rid of trace SD from solid and inf from nymph. And it gives me a whole variety of words here. And one of them, in fact, the only one that has OLI, or the first one that has OLI not in the middle of the word, is lingo down here. But there's other ways you can look for it too. For example, that slash slash, in other words, looking up an anagram of noli plus an unknown letter. And there are a restricted number of letters here. So as you can see, login is there, but it has a no in the second spot. So O is not going to work when it's in the second spot because it was a yellow letter. It wasn't a green letter. And none of the other ones look very good to me. Lingo looks to be the best choice. So I put in lingo and bingo. I won Wordle in four guesses as opposed to six. And sometimes you can get them in two, depending on what your best guess is to start with. So that's one choice. And here's they have an explanation as to how the wild card patterns work with asterisk, etc. You can have comma to combine multiple patterns. This is what I use for the second choice, double slashes before a group of letters to unscramble them, that is to find anagrams. And, of course, minus sign to get rid of letters that you know are not in the word. And there's more advice on how to use wildcard patterns. And there is a special crossword mode. So there's a customized page in OneLover. So you can change the way the wildcards work, etc. But if you're working with crossword puzzles, sometimes that you have two words with no spaces that you put in. So, for example, searching for H question mark TTOT, you'll find hot to trot. While this one will find African lily. So crossword puzzle mode works well when you're using when you're trying to solve a crossword puzzle. So you can take that New York Times Sunday puzzle and figure it all out in, you know, 5 minutes or so. You can also find slang. For example, a newbie. There's lots of definitions of newbie here. A newcomer, a new user, anything recently introduced into a setting, especially something that replaces an older version. So it gives you one of the definitions here. Similar words, opposite words, types, things that are related, and adjectives like clueless, which is a good adjective for newbie, or hooking up. This is a word I discovered a few years ago. It has a new meaning in slang. To have a casual sexual experience with another person, usually without any future relationship intended. And that's a fairly new word in the last 5 or 10 years. And you can look up abbreviations like NASA, or any other abbreviation. And this is the site, https://onelook.com. And I would like to thank SlidesGo for this template. As you can see, it's an eclipse template, since we're having the eclipse on April the 8th in the afternoon. And that's it.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom.
Are there any questions?
Nothing in the chat. But we do, before we move on, we did have a question that perhaps Jeff can answer. Does Facebook Purity work on any browser?
Jeff did actually answer that one, Chris.
Oh, he did. Okay, sorry.
In the chat.
That. Yeah, okay, I missed that. Sorry.
When does it say? He said he knows that there are extensions for Chrome, Brave, Edge, Opera, and Firefox. He's not sure what others are supported, but if you go to the Facebook Purity website, it will outline which browsers it supports. Okay, moving on then, we have an item here from Chris.
Yeah, so Google Chrome has a feature built into it that is called Safe Browsing. And what it does is it looks at, you know, the fact that you know, if you're accessing websites, the Google Chrome Safe Browsing actually looks at over 10 billion URLs and files each day, and it updates a locally stored list of potentially dangerous sites and files, and that list gets updated every 30 to 60 minutes. And so if you happen to try to go to one of these sites that is on that danger list, you get this pop-up that allows you to, you know, avoid going to that dangerous site. Next. So the default is what's known as standard protection. And to get there, you go into the menus and you go to settings. Next. And then once you're in settings, you go to, everything is so small for me on this one here, sorry, privacy and security. And then you go down to security, and then you scroll down to the bit on safe browsing. And as you can see there, the default is standard. So you will get blocking automatically in the Chrome browser, which is a good thing. Next. But is that really fast enough? You know, it's every 30 to 60 minutes that that list gets updated. And one might be thinking that, well, that's pretty often, and how dangerous can I actually be? Next. And Google found on an average malicious sites exist for less than 10 minutes. So malicious sites get populated, I guess, get linked or something, I don't know, and then they disappear within 10 minutes. So 30 to 60 minutes is actually not frequent enough for it to update that locally stored list of bad sites and files. Next. So they decided to change the behavior of it. And so what they're doing now, or it's coming up real soon, is it is going to check sites against Google's server-side list of known bad sites in real time. And they expect to actually block 25% more phishing attempts based on this change in behavior that they have for the safe browsing feature. So I think that's pretty cool. Next. Something else that you might want to consider is I did point out that it's standard protection is what's enabled by default. You might want to consider enhanced protection, and I have on the screen what that looks like in terms of what it's going to block and allow. I've had enhanced protection on for probably over a year, and I have not personally noticed any downside to having it turned on. However, the one thing that privacy people may go a little bit nuts over. Next. You'll see here it sends URLs to safe browsing to check them. And so this is how Google, I guess, is going to update things. Or I guess that's where the blocking actually does come in, is that it is sending the URL that you're trying to browse to Google in order for it to check them out in the new method of the server-side blocking. And so some privacy people might say, well, I don't really want to let Google know where I'm browsing. Next. In the blog posting that I pointed to in the previous slide, and it's in the chat window, this is a quote. They say, uses encryption and other privacy-enhancing techniques to ensure that no one, including Google, knows what website you're visiting. I have absolutely no clue what that means, and I don't know whether you should believe it or not. That's up to you. Next. And then another quote from it. While this does require some additional horsepower from the browser, we've worked to make sure your experience remains smooth and speedy. And again, I have no idea what that really means. However, I personally welcome this as an addition to Google or extended capability within Google. And you might want to consider it as well. And that's all I have on that.
So Tom is wondering if you wait 11 minutes to click on a phishing site, if you're so insane.
Hey, that's the average malicious website. I'm sure that there are some malicious sites that will exist for years, and maybe some that will disappear in shorter than 10 minutes. So no, I would not consider that to be a safe method of browsing.
And his other comment is that you can also use Quad9 DNS to shield from bad sites.
Yep. There's a number of DNS services that are available out there that do that, certainly I use them. There's the Canadian Shield from Sierra. as well as I use Quad9, have used it for years, and it's not a bad idea to have multiple sites deciding whether you're safe to visit a particular site or not. So personally, I welcome this addition to Google Chrome, even though I use Quad9.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So the next thing I've got is a follow-up from a question I had a few years ago, April 2021, in fact. I was having a problem where I had a file which was quite large, 110 pages at the time.
Wow.
And normally I'm working on this right at the end of the file, so I would have expected LibreOffice Writer to save the cursor location at the end of the file. So when I open the file a second time, it starts off where I left off. However, in this particular case, although there are 110 pages, it seems to choose kind of a random page somewhere in the middle of the file. So it's opening, in this case, at page 89 instead of page 110. And this turned out to be a bug, which I reported and lots of other people have reported. And I note, again, this was April 2021. It turns out after several versions of LibreOffice, it's still an issue in March of 2024. And they haven't fixed the bug. It only affects large files. You have to have a lot of text in your file before this will become a problem. However, there's some workarounds, and the one I always used was Control-N, because that moves the cursor directly to the end of the file, which is where I generally want to be. However, there was a posting recently on one of the bug reports with another option, which I think is kind of neat. One of Bob Harris's keyboard shortcuts, I guess, if you can remember it, Shift F5 moves the cursor to the last position that you had where you were using the file. So the last used position in the file, Shift F5, as opposed to Control N, which takes it to the end of the file. So if either of those two keystrokes are useful to you when you're opening LibreOffice documents, then there are a couple of shortcuts which will get you there in a hurry. And hopefully one of these days will fix that bug, because it drives me nuts. Okay, moving right along. Another item from Chris.
Yeah, this is a really cool site run by Google. It's been around for a number of years, actually. I just came across it. So it's Google Arts and Culture. And it's high-res images and videos of artwork, cultural artifacts, and so forth from around the world. And there are like thousands of galleries and other cultural organizations found throughout the world that they've got information on. So you can explore their works. It has a lot of extra information on the site about the particular artworks and so forth. And there's all kinds of search capabilities that you have built into it as well. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, it's a great site to explore. You can get lost in it. And thousands and thousands of sites that lots of information available.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I guess the next item is a follow-up on Tom's slide template, because Chris has got some information here on the upcoming solar eclipse.
Yeah, so we talked about this in the chat window a couple of times before meeting started lately, and so I went exploring a little bit on it, especially once I found out that although we don't have totality in Ottawa, we're going to come pretty close. So the solar eclipse is on Monday, April 8th, next. That map is actually showing the path of the totality. And so they have lines on it that show areas where there will be less than totality and 5% increments. And you can see that Ottawa is very close to being in totality. We will actually have about 98. Actually, I saw something that said we'll have better than 98.5% of totality. Most of North America will actually see at least a partial eclipse, which I thought was pretty cool. And let me just paste this into the chat. Okay, next. So there's this other site here, which was kind of cool because it has a simulation of what it's going to look like, and it'll run as a little video clip. So you can see in the top left-hand corner, that's when the eclipse is sort of starting, and this is how it should appear in Ottawa. And so then you see it's actually starting at 2:21, well, a little before 2:21 p.m. on that day, and then the eclipse continues on, and it's going to go until after 4:15 before we lose the effect of the eclipse at all. So it's quite a long event for the whole thing. We will not see totality. So the one you see that is the fourth down from the top left is pretty close to the maximum we're going to actually experience. And if you're interested in doing this, and especially if you're interested in photographing it, Hudson Henry is a photographer I follow out of Oregon, and he has this weekly thing he puts on approaching the scene. And his 294th presentation, which was just last week, was how to practice and shoot the total eclipse. And he has an actual exposure guide in PDF format that he has, which would be very helpful. So he talks about lens filtration and using a 16-stop neutral density filter versus a solar filter, and what the differences are, and why he thinks that you can get by with just 16-stop neutral density filter without endangering your equipment. He talks about different focal length choices that you can make, and you can see in the two photos, one of them is a fairly wide angle shot that he's taken, and then he has a telephoto shot of it of just showing the total eclipse. And this was from another workshop that he did, the last solar eclipse there was. I forget exactly when it was. He has exposure settings that he recommends for before the eclipse actually starts, going all the way through totality. Talks about doing exposure bracketing in order to get good exposures, how to focus on the sun. And then he talks in particular about practicing it. And he says, don't go out on the day of the eclipse and expect to have successful photos unless you've actually practiced it. So practice in advance, and he is going to have an upcoming approaching the scene where he talks about post-processing the images that you do get. So he'll be doing that after the eclipse when he gets back from his workshop in Mazatlan, Mexico, which is where he's heading to be able to photograph this eclipse, because it is the maximum totality and some of the best weather out there. So he's almost certain to not have clouds obscure the eclipse or anything like that. So if you're interested, that's the information I have on it.
Well, you've got some more.
Oh, yeah, I do have another one. Sorry. Yeah, if you are going to miss this one for North America, the next total eclipse of the sun ain't coming for a while. Next. So it only covers out in Western Canada for totality, and it's going to happen August 23rd, 2044. So if you do like the idea of an eclipse, by all means, get in on the game in this round. There was something in the chat window about solar glasses. Allison said, I'm wondering if the glasses are safe as well. I'd like to see it, but I'm nervous. There are lots of places you can get solar glasses. I just recently just got some on Amazon. I probably paid too much for them, but it was a two-pack for $15. You can get on Amazon, you can get like 10 packs for about $20. And apparently they're all certified, the ISO certification on them and things like that. So I think as long as you get one that it looks like it's not by a fly-by-night outfit, the Royal Astronomical Society, I think they were selling them. I checked their site just recently, and I couldn't find them on their site. So I'm not sure about that. Natalie says she saw that Home Hardware is selling glasses to view the eclipse. And there is an ISO certification for solar filters. And I forget the actual number, but if you go on the Amazon site, you'll see a lot of them claiming ISO certification. So you can get that number if you care about that. Timothy says he's driving down to Spencerville, so he'll get totality. Tom says welding glasses will work. Also, fully exposed and developed Tri-X film. I would not trust fully exposed and developed Tri-X film. And I'm not even sure I would trust welding glasses either. unless there's some authoritative source that says that they are certified for solar. One of the problems with viewing the sun, if you are viewing it, especially in a magnified sense or staring at it for a long period of time, your eye has no pain receptors. Your retina has no pain receptors. So you will not feel that it's discomfort or hurting your eye, and it can do permanent damage to your eyes. So be careful.
The problem is the UV light, which is why welding glasses work, because they're designed to basically get rid of the UV, because basically you get a sunburn on your eye. And because your eye is so sensitive that you can lose your sight permanently where the sun's shone on your eye. So you definitely need glasses if you're going to look up at the sun outside of totality. I'd also like to suggest that don't miss totality. It's really completely different from 98.5%. It's a difference between, it's an experience. I did actually go to see the 2017 eclipse. I went down to, Iowa. And unfortunately, it was cloudy. And if it's cloudy, you can skip it, which is actually likely. But if it's sunny or partly cloudy, you definitely should go. And all you have to do is head towards the St. Lawrence River. And if you're along the St. Lawrence in Kingston or Brockville or Cornwall or anywhere along the 401 or the Parkway, you'll get a great view, and it should last a couple of minutes there. And because you see everything becomes very different. Take a look at some of the YouTube videos of full eclipses, and you'll see it's quite different than just 98.5%.
You see some stars too during the total.
So Natalie said there's an expert who was saying that cell phones don't have safe filters, so it's not safe to watch through the smartphone camera setting.
No.
Comments, anyone?
Use an eye, one of the, if you have a spare eyeglasses, use that to view the sun. That's what I did with my camera in the 2017 eclipse.
That's spare eyeglasses? I don't understand.
Spare solar glasses.
Yeah, the spare solar glasses you wear to see the sun. If you have an extra one, use that for your smartphone, if that's what you're using, or for your camera, which is what I had for the 2017 eclipse. It works well.
Okay, moving along then. We have a share here, another one from Jeff. Pointing out that phishing is a real problem in terms of scams, and the way to get rid of it is to just delete the message. But it's also important, he says, to report them to your cell provider to protect yourself and others from the same attacks. And there's this website, getcybersafe.ca, which is actually a government website, which has information on this. So Jeff said you should be cautious about receiving text messages from sources you don't know. If you're in doubt, confirm the supposed source and make sure it is from them. Don't reply to spurious messages and never click on any links in such messages. But here's the information. Forward the message to 7726, which spells out spam on most keyboards. And the website says this will alert your cellular provider to open an investigation on the contents of the message. So that's what Jeff says, that's what the site says. So I guess it's up to you whether you wish to do that or not. Okay, Chris has a share on AI.
Yeah, I came across it in this week's Bruce Schneier's monthly newsletter called Cryptogram. So he puts this out, and you'll get an email if you subscribe to it, or you can go to his website to get it. And it's just a huge collection of security-related articles, and he'll have usually a brief synopsis, and then he'll have links to where he got the information or supporting information or contrary information or whatever. And it's actually a very interesting newsletter if anybody's interested in security. And it actually goes beyond computer security. He's also concerned about physical security and things like that. Well, this March 15th issue that came out had a lot of articles involving AI, and I list the, seven there that did have some dealings with AI. The LLMs are large language models, which is how most AI systems work. And so if you are interested in AI in particular, how it affects security or security affects it, and you might want to check out his latest issue. And so I pasted that into the chat as well.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so now we have a question. It's very recent. I actually read this email just a few minutes before the session went online. And it's from Linda, and she says that for some reason, none of the Office programs are showing recent files or folders that she had pinned. And despite a full-length Microsoft Online repair, they haven't resolved the issue. So, of course, I went to open this PowerPoint deck to show you all tonight, and I got this message that says, you haven't opened any documents recently. And I checked, and I get the same thing in Word. You can see right here, here's Word being open, and whereas normally I would have a list of recent files here, it says I haven't opened anything recently. Well, that's not true, because I've been working on a newsletter article several times this afternoon, so there should be at least one file there, and probably several. So Chris is wondering whether there's been a poor Microsoft update somewhere. I don't know whether anybody else has noticed this problem in Microsoft Office. It seems strange that it would happen to Linda and myself and nobody else. So I suspect
it hadn't affected me at all. Another side effect that who knows if it's actually related or not, but the jump list, Linda ran into this, where the jump list on the Windows taskbar, which if you right-click on it, normally you will also get recent documents that you had opened as well as pinned documents, that's empty on her computer. And so it affected not only the recent file list within the Office applications, but also the jump lists on the taskbar.
Well, I guess we'll see what transpires on that over the next week or so. Maybe we'll have a follow-up.
Yeah.
So if anybody runs into that problem, let us know. Carol says she does have recent files showing. So.
And Tom has no problem either. PIN documents are working in Office 2007. Oh, and that's a supported version of Office.
And Karen says she had it, but when closed and reopened, it seemed to resolve.
Oh, yeah. Linda tried that. She tried to reboot. And that didn't help either. Interesting.
Okay. All right. So we're coming up to the last 10 minutes. If anybody has any other questions, we will entertain them for sure. But I do have one more item, just a general interest and for some action. Our club has joined another group, the International Association of Technology and Computer User Groups, APCUG. This is an organization of user groups mostly based in the US. However, there are also some Canadian and some Australian groups involved also. The reason we join them is, as everybody must be aware, we have problems obtaining volunteers. We need people to act as speakers at meetings, and we need people to write articles for the newsletter. And although we've had some success in having people do these things, it's been rather limited, and especially the speakers is a problem. We don't have a speaker, it's kind of hard to have a meeting. Anyway, the reason we joined APCUG was because they offer a speakers bureau, and they also have a source of newsletter articles, in addition to some benefits which are specific to group members.
Just before you go on, Alan, I'll point out that they do actually, I believe, understand acronyms at the APCUG. They used to be called the Association of PC User Groups, and so they changed their name for some reason at some point, but they didn't bother changing their acronym.
Okay, I wondered about that. Okay, so the Speakers Bureau, basically what happens is members of the clubs that belong to the organization offer presentations to other affiliated groups. And for example, Chris has just given his typography presentation to a group in Madison, Wisconsin. Now, they tell us on their website that they have more than 100 presentations in more than 20 categories. So we have to go through those and see what might be of interest to us. And I just pulled out a few examples here, which I thought were interesting. Computers to the Moon. I got no idea what that is, whether it's the original PC that went on the first mission to the moon or something really weird and wonderful. I don't know. Cell phone tethering has always interested me, but I've never actually got around to doing it or finding out much about it. And so there's a possible topic. I don't think we've ever had anything on cell phone tethering at OPCUG. And similarly, I don't think we've had anything on a home automation, although lots of people have various devices that the smart devices that they have in their house. The newsletter articles, again, this is the same kind of thing. They're articles which are written by group members, sometimes by sponsors of various products, but typically newsletter articles from different groups. The editors give permission to use the articles in other groups' newsletters, and then bundles of articles are sent to the newsletter editors for review and use as they feel fit. And so they call this a push system. And you may have seen in the last Ottawa PC News, there was this article on charging smartphones and tablets, actually from the editor of the Central Kentucky Computer Society, which Bridget basically obtained this this article through APCUG, and we may end up using some of those kind of things in the future. And then in terms of benefits to individual members, if you're interested, APCUG holds regular Wednesday workshops. Now they're longer, they're a bit like our Q&A sessions, but they tend to focus on a particular topic or a couple of different topics, rather than being a general sort of thing. And they're much longer than ours. They generally something like 2 to 3 hours. They start at noon, which is good because they don't conflict with our meetings at 7 p.m. Right now they've been held, well, they're held as Zoom sessions because clearly it's an international audience. And the third Wednesday workshop is devoted to Linux. They call them Learning Linux workshops. And I actually gave a presentation this morning on backup systems for Linux. So if you're interested in taking part in any of these, you have to go through the process. APCUG seems to be big on processes. So you can add your email address and be able to receive invitations to the workshop, or notices of the workshop anyway. And they have an online form. There's the URL. You need to put in your name and your email address and the full name of your club. So you have to put in Ottawa PC Users Group, not OPCUG. Once you've done that, then you will receive a notice of meeting by email, and then you have to register for that meeting. And once you've registered, then a link to the Zoom session will be sent to you by email. So it's a bit of a process, but it actually works quite well. Now, the second thing they have, which is maybe of interest to some people, is the group sharing meeting. So this gives you the ability to attend meetings of other user groups. And the way I would suggest you do it is to go to APCUG's website, which is at this URL, and then look on the left-hand side of the homepage for this this tile group sharing meetings, and then you'll find there that there's a link where you can look at the member groups listed by time zone. So then you can check the details of the meetings. So here's a couple of examples. There's the Durham Computer Users Group, and here's one in a canton, which I think is Ohio, right? So you click on their link, see when their meetings are and what the topic's going to be, and see if you're interested in participating in that. Just one cautionary note. The website looks bright and shiny, but there's a lot of dead-end links, and there's a lot of links which suggest that the page hasn't been updated for a long time. And for example, the Wednesday workshops, I think the last Wednesday workshop that they record was based in May last year, although they've had a number of workshops this year. They just haven't got around to updating that page. So just take that with a grain of salt. Okay, now if you want us to avoid using APCUG in any great way, then we need your ideas. So you've seen this slide before, the OPCUG idea generator, AI specific, and all of the things that we're interested in. You know all those things, questions and presentations and all kinds of wonderful things. And just a couple of things. We do want suggestions for presentation topics. We're always looking for speakers. We're always looking for ideas for topics. We're booked up right now until December, but starting in December, we need to start a new list. And Chris and I are always interested in input into the Q&A sessions. I was kind of worried we wouldn't have enough material for tonight, but it seems as though we're doing quite well. However, you know, we don't know what you want to know about. We know what we're interested in and what we can tell you about, but if you have a question or something you're interested in, now just ask us, because if we don't know, we'll find out, or we'll find somebody who does know, or try to at least. And then if you have the poison pen, if you have the ballpoint pen at the ready or a typewriter, and you desperately want to write a computer-related article, again, Bridget is always looking for new material for the newsletter, and I think we can almost guarantee that you can become a published author probably next month even. So contact Bridget if you have any inkling on any computer-related newsletter articles. All right, so now we're into the last 10 minutes, the last 14 minutes, I think. I asked if there are any questions, and I noticed one early on from Karen, and it said, if I find it, here we are. Does the group have any comments on Edge, Microsoft Edge? I received a notice or an invitation to try out new features on Edge. They seem to be doing more than Chrome, including a built-in VPN, virtual private network. So has anybody tried the new version of Edge? Have you got any comments on any new features in Edge? Have you got a browser that you prefer to Edge? All contributions welcome.
I use Edge when I use ChatGPT. It's useful. It's like a super search engine. It'll get you more information. The only problem is kind of trusting it, but that's a common problem with large language models. But Edge is nice, but it's my... I use the browser. It's my sixth most used browser in my portfolio. I use mainly Firefox because I can really lock it down. I think it's good. It's good for Copilot. Open ChatGPT on it and get more information or start coding. I would definitely use it for that.
Yeah, probably is not a bad choice for any Microsoft property. they're going to make sure that all their web pages work really, really well with Edge. So, and ChatGPT is now they've got the interface in from Microsoft because they invested $10 billion into it. So I use Edge on a fairly regular basis. It's not my main browser. I personally have not used any of the enhanced features that are not available in any of the other browsers. I don't see any reason to avoid it necessarily. Kind of cool that they do have a VPN now. I was not aware of that.
One thing they do have that I've used once or twice is if you're shopping, they have they will find coupons for you for your shopping, and gives you dollars off. So that might be useful to some people or everybody if they're doing any shopping online.
Yeah, nice.
Well, I noticed a question in the chat from Carol. She says, does it matter if the articles are the same as a presentation? And Chris replies, no reason, why not? And I just point out, if you've read the newsletter and looked at some of my presentations, you'll see that that's exactly what I've been doing quite recently. And actually, you know, to be serious, it's actually a good reason. And there are less people on the Q&A calls than read the newsletter or that we have members. So providing the information as a newsletter article basically hits more people. So it is a worthwhile exercise.
I think having it as a different, it's a different format as well, written as opposed to spoken and displayed. And I think there's certain value in that as well. So even if you're covering the same or a very similar topic, it can be covered in a different manner. So I think it's a good idea.
All right, Karen, Karen, I noticed that you had a hand raised earlier and I didn't get to it. And now you've taken it down. So did I pose your question or do you still have something that you want to add?
Thanks, Alan, for asking, and thanks, everybody, for the input on Edge. I had a question, but I don't remember what it is now because I was...
Okay, moving on.
And I just wanted to have a bit more with the Edge is there's so much going on there, and I never... The amount of time to take and process and absorb everything that they're presenting and what you're saying yes to and what that's allowing, I just found it... I said, oh, my God, I'm going to have to come back to this when I've got another couple hours to pay attention. And that's partly why I asked, just to see if somebody had a Coles Notes summary to say what was going on, because they've got DALL-E, they've got ChatGPT, they've got this powerful, as Tom pointed out, this shopping feature. There's stuff everywhere, and it just seemed, again, we talked a little bit about security earlier on, and that it's wonderful to have all of these features, but at the same time, I don't know how much of it is a lure to get me in to gather more stuff that I don't even really know that I'm agreeing to. And that's part of why I was probing a little bit, because I know that this group pays a lot of attention and does a lot of scrutiny around some of those things. And it just seemed completely over it. It's got all those bells and whistles and say, ooh, now your bright, shiny stuff attracted me. But at the same time, again, that sometimes is the lure, and I'm so concerned about data, and I'm so concerned about security, and I'm so concerned about what everything's, how much information is being taken, because at the same time I'm getting my malware bite that says, watch this, watch that. So that's also why I'm probing and asking a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a really hard question to sort of address that, because not only is it just what is there now, but it's a moving target because they're constantly changing the browser and the way it operates and the features it has and things like that. So I tend to, whenever they come up with that thing of, oh, you now have a new version of Edge and here's the new things you can do, I usually just ignore it because I just go, I like you, I don't, you know, don't have time to go into the nitty-gritty of new features in the browser. I suppose I should look at it a little bit more. I might have noticed that there was a VPN, which could be useful to me. But, yeah, it's real difficult.
Exactly, Chris, and that's why this group with so many minds, and I know many of you take the time to probe these kind of things, and I know, Tom, you're always putting out stuff, and I really appreciate that, and Harvey and some of the other guys putting stuff through the members forum. It is very helpful because I don't have time, and maybe there is something that would help save me time, but I don't have enough time to ensure that it saves me time but doesn't compromise me in another way.
So Tom has a question on BitLocker. How do I switch to full disk encryption? So does anybody use BitLocker and knows the answer to that? And Tom has his hand up, so I'll let him talk to something or other.
Okay. Yeah, I have a problem with my computer. And one of the solutions that was suggested on the internet was to turn off BitLocker and then turn it on again, because my writing speed on my C drive is very slow. It should be up around 2 or 3,000 megabytes per second, and it's down around 200 or 300. I think it's probably, I don't know why, and I do get these little red notices in the right corner of my scene saying encrypting. So I'd like to basically get rid of BitLocker or turn off BitLocker and then re-enable it. But one of the problems I have is that I have BitLocker now on both my C drive and my D drive, which is a separate SSD. And when I tried to turn off BitLocker on my C drive, it said, "Oh, the C drive also has the key to my Z drive, which is my other drive on the machine." I can't turn off BitLocker now because it has these keys. And so I have to send a command in to erase the keys to my my second disk drive. I printed out the keys to my BitLocker on my C drive. I'll have to print them out, I guess, for my Z drive as well. But I have actually copied them onto a USB for safety. But I'd like to know if anybody has had any experience with BitLocker turning it on or off, and has any advice to give me before I go on further, aside from backing up beforehand.
Now, there's nothing in the chat, and nobody's saying anything. You might want to post that in the members forum, Tom. You'll get more coverage that way.
Thank you.
Okay, did you see anything else, Chris, pop in there?
No, I don't think so. Just some comments and that, but no questions, I think. If you did have a question that you put into the chat and we missed it, by all means, unmute yourself or throw it into the chat again. We're just coming up on the last 3 minutes or so, so we do have time. I see a note from Bob Gowan about home automation presentations. I presume that that's related to the APCUG. One of their speakers bureaus was offering something on home automation. One of the problems I have with the APCUG and their speakers bureau is the fact that their list of presentations give no indication about the length of presentations. And so I suspect that some of them are actually quite short and probably not suitable for our main monthly meeting. Could be useful for a Q&A if we invited them to speak at the start of Q&A if they have a 10 or 15 minute presentation or something like that. But it's a little bit difficult navigating the APCUG. They don't have the contact information for any of these people that are in the speaker bureau, so you have to go through the APCUG, request a speaker and a time, and they forward it on to the speaker, and then you wait, and maybe the speaker will get back to you, and maybe they won't. So it's a little bit of a rocky start with them, really, but some possibilities there.
And Tom Tristan has just put something in the chat, an article about BitLocker with a link. You might want to refer to that. And I think Bob was actually posting that because I had said that I didn't think we'd had anything on home automation at the club. Okay. And he's pointing out that we did,
about
20 years ago almost.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to do the last one.
Carol, Carol was waving her hand.
I just, if you block a spam, is that helpful or?
Oh, yeah. I suspect in most cases it doesn't really help you at all because, are you talking about text spams or email?
Yeah, either or.
I suspect they're both the same. Email spam, I never bother blocking if it comes through because they typically you will never get another spam from that same email address.
Yeah.
And so they spoof the where it's coming from in order to make sure that nobody tracks them down. And so I think it's a mug's game to try to block them. You end up just bogging down your mail system or text messaging system with, you know, additional things that are being blocked. That's my personal opinion on it. Probably doesn't really hurt that much, but I doubt it helps.
Also, sometimes spam comes from people that are friends of yours because they come across email addresses in groups and emails that have been sent to a bunch of people, and then they use one of the addresses in the group email to send mail to the other addresses in the group email. So it may not be a good idea to block spam messages on a regular basis. I mean, I have two keystrokes that actually send spam to a spam folder and put the address in a block. But I always actually review my spam every day. I review my spam folder to check that I'm not missing things. And fortunately, it hasn't overwhelmed me quite yet.
I don't think that's the same with text messages, though. I think I get phone calls and text messages from the same number quite a bit. But then it depends on which app you're using to manage your phone and manage your SMS.
Yeah.
Mine isn't all that good, I don't think. I block a number, and it says I'm never going to get a call from them ever again, but it lets the calls go to voicemail, which, you know, to me, that's not really blocking it. Anyway. Okay, well, if anybody has any other thoughts, comments, questions, answers, let us know in the chat or in an email to suggestion box, and we'll add some stuff in next week. So finishing off this week, we've hit the magic hour. If anybody is not a member, if you are a member of the club right now, if you've paid your membership fee sometime in the dim distant past, the board is extending everybody's membership by an additional year. So at no cost. So you don't have to renew your membership if you are a member. If you're not a member, then we have a special offer. If you pay us $20 and buy a one-year membership, we will give you a second year's membership at no extra cost. So you're getting, as it says here, buy one and get one free. However, that offer right now is only good until March 31st. So, just over a week and a half, let's say. If you're not a member, or if you know somebody who's not a member who is thinking of joining, 10 days or so is the optimal time to join. Our next meeting will be next Wednesday. We have another Q&A session. I don't think I have anything in the pipe. Yes, I do. I think there is one item coming up next week. But there's always room for more. So if you have questions or if you have topics that you'd like to share, like the ones we've talked about tonight, or you want to follow up on some of the discussions we've had, you've got information, send it along and we'll add it to next week's Q&A. So I hope everybody enjoyed the information tonight. Thanks everybody for participating. Good discussions on lots of things. And we'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.